We're going to be walking through the second paragraph of the second chapter of the London Baptist Confession of Faith, and I promise you we're going to make it through the entirety of this paragraph. I know on the first paragraph we took some time to really walk through some of the specific doctrines that we saw within that paragraph, but my intention is to walk through the entirety of this paragraph. Or so we'll see. We'll see what I do. But let's begin here. I'll go ahead and read. I'll read paragraph two. Actually, no. I'm doing about a third of paragraph two. I'm sorry. But let's walk through the self-sufficiency of God. That's what I'm titling this first portion of the second paragraph of paragraph two. And it says, God having life, all life, glory, goodness, blessedness, in and of himself, is alone in and unto himself all sufficient, not standing in any need of any creature which he hath made, nor deriving any glory from them, but only manifesting his glory in, by, unto, and upon them. He is alone the fountain of all being, of whom, through whom, and to whom are all things. And he hath most sovereign dominion over all creatures, to do by them, for them, or upon them, whatsoever himself pleases. In the sight of all things are open and manifest. His knowledge is infinite, infallible, and dependent upon the creature, so as nothing is to him contingent or uncertain. He is most holy in all his counsels, in all his works, in all his commands. To him is due from angels and men whatsoever worship, service, or obedience as creatures they owe unto the Creator, and whatever he is further pleased to require upon them. We have a paragraph here that talks about the aseity of God. This is his self-sufficiency. I'm going to take a moment to adjust how this display is working. Think about it. Ask yourself this question. What does God need? What is it that God is in need of? Is there anything you can think of that God needs? Well, God is in need of absolutely nothing. God is complete in and of himself. Now, this is something that is an area where people err in. Many times, in a desire to really encourage people to do something that is good, to encourage people to do something that is noble, something that is beneficial to other people, someone will say, well, God really needs you to do this. God needs people like you to fulfill this particular void that is here. But God is in need of nothing. Well, are we to say that God, for all creation, was absent in this particular area of his existence? That God in and of himself was insufficient prior to bringing you into existence, whereby, although for all eternity he was lacking, he can now be complete? Well, we know that's dangerous. We know that's foolishness. We know that a God like that would be no God at all. A God like that would not be sufficient. A God like that would be insufficient. And that's the idea of the aseity of God. God is complete in and of himself. He's not in need of anything. Nobody supports God. Nobody gives anything to God that he didn't already have, that he didn't already own. We see him walk through this in the Psalms, where he says, you know, if I were hungry, I wouldn't call you. The cattle on 1,000 hills are mine. Imagine that. God's not going to get hungry in the first place. We know that. But if he were hungry, he wouldn't call you. You wouldn't be the one that would be feeding him. He already has all the food he could ever want to eat, but he doesn't need it. He was never in need of it. So we need to be careful of this when we encourage people to do something good, even when it's noble, even when it's something they absolutely should be doing, when it's something that God desires of them, that it's something that is the will of God, that God has commanded them to do, we must be cautious that we give them an encouragement, that we slander God, is what I would say. I believe that's what we do when we say something about God that is not true. When we say something about God that may be a compliment for one of us, but is inconsistent with who God is, we are slandering his very character, his very nature. We should encourage people to walk in obedience, not because there's something lacking in God, not to go into the mission field because God needs them, or to go into ministry because God needs them, or to be a good mother or father because God needs them. No, there's a better reason than that, because first off, that's not a reason to do it in the first place. It's not true. God doesn't need you. God was God before you came into existence, and God will be God long after you depart this planet, whether that be through a natural death or through the return of Christ. But the reason why you should walk in obedience is because you were made in the image of God. You were designed to walk in obedience to him. You were designed to walk in a way that is consistent with his moral law. And even more than that, even greater than that, you, dear Christian, you are one whom Christ Jesus has come on behalf of, one who has fulfilled the law on your behalf, one who has taken upon himself the full propitiation of your sin. What greater reason could you have to walk in obedience? As Paul says in Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 10, "For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we would walk in them." So that is the reason we're to walk into obedience. That's the reason we are to walk in obedience in whatever station of life that we are in. That is the reason you should go into missions if the Lord is calling you into that. You should go into ministry if the Lord is calling you into that. Not because there's something lacking in God, but something lacking in you. You need to walk in this area. This is what God is calling you to. So let's walk through this. This first portion I'm going to call God is self-sufficient. I'm going to read it again. God, having all life, glory, goodness, blessedness in and of himself, is alone in and unto himself all sufficient, not standing in need of any creature which he hath made, nor deriving any glory from them, but only manifesting his own glory in, by, unto, and upon them. They begin by saying God is the source of all life. We don't give God life. That's not something that's difficult for us to understand. But that's kind of a pagan idea of God, that in some way you are giving blessings to him, and you're some way enriching him. You're making him stronger. You see this idea. I think you see this idea very well when perhaps you go to get your hair cut somewhere sometimes, or you go into some kind of a small business retail store, and you'll see some little idols there. And what do you see before those little idols on the ground? Many times they're on the ground. I don't know why they're on the ground, but the many times they're on the ground, you see food. And you see food there. And it doesn't cross the person's mind that every day they set the food there, and unless some kind of a child walks by and grabs it, or a rodent grabs it, the food is still there. They're not actually eating the food. So I'm sure there's some, you know, some kind of a theological idea they have that they are actually pulling, you know, what is good for them out of that food. This is an errant idea. What kind of a God is a God that needs you? What kind of a God is it that needs to sustain you? No, that you sustain, rather, is what I would say. No, God is the source of all life. God is the source of all life. John 5 and verse 26, Jesus says, "For as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son also to have life in himself." This is an idea that people can understand and they can see merely looking at the creation itself. God is the source of all life. I would argue this. You don't even need the Bible to tell you that. it is fascinating. I find it incredibly fascinating how men of great education, with all might, with all volition, will fight tooth and nail and claw against any evidence of the existence of God, when the evidence of God's existence is absolutely overwhelming. God being the source of life is something that is evident in the fact that there is life. You don't even need the Bible to tell you this reality. The Bible just begins there. In the beginning, God. Makes no qualifications. Just comes to you speaking of the one you already know of. The one you already know is in existence. The one you already know brought you into existence. In the beginning, God. And a statement there that it makes an argument that God is the source of life. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And we know this even looking at the world now. Life doesn't come from non-life. It doesn't matter how much time you have. It doesn't matter how much lightning you have. It doesn't matter how much salt you have. None of this really matters. It doesn't matter how much time and chance that you have. You are not going to create life from non-life. And furthermore, even greater absurdity, nothing isn't going to become something and then blow up and become everything. And so if God is the source of all life, it stands to reason that he has life in and of himself. No one could give him life. I remember talking with a Jehovah's Witness a little while back, and many times when you talk with a Jehovah's Witness, they like to come to you and they like to talk about John chapter 1. And they want to sit on your front porch and have a Greek lesson with you about whether or not there is an indefinite article in Greek. And in fact, there is not an indefinite article in Greek. You have to use reason, and there's rules that you follow in determining whether or not you have an indefinite article in a particular location. And so they like to talk about 1 John 1 and 2 with you. It says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. I like to say, you know, really, if you understand the Greek there, now they don't understand the Greek, but they will say, if you understand the Greek there, there should be an indefinite article there, and it should say, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was a God. Now, there's a whole lot of problems with even making a statement like that, and it's an incredible way for him to have begun his gospel if he were to do that, which is that is not what he did. But I like to say, you know, I'm not a Greek scholar, and you're not a Greek scholar. So let's just go to verse 3 in your so-called New World Translation. And verse 3 says, all things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that has been made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. And I ask this question. So you tell me that God made Jesus, but it says here, all things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that has been made. John qualifies that statement. Not only were all things made through him, and maybe you could say, well, all doesn't mean all. He qualifies the all there, and he says, and without him was not anything made that has been made. So logically, what you're saying there, sir, by the translation that you're holding in your hand, is you're saying that Jesus is the means through which all things came into existence that have been brought into existence. But you say that Jesus has been brought into existence. So pray tell, how is it that Jesus brought himself into existence when he was in a state of non-existence? Well, he could not have done that. So perhaps we don't need an article there. We don't need an indefinite article. Jesus is God. And that's not the only reason why we need to look at that. But that's an absurdity. Life can't come from non-life. Nothing can't bring something into existence. And so furthermore, if we could add to the life of God, he would in fact not be God. And you would have no basis for your existence at all. That would mean he is a God who is mutable, he is changing, he is one way this day, another way, another day. Life comes from God. And that is the reality. God is the source. He is the author of life. And if he is not, if God is not the source and author of life, your life has no meaning. Your life has no significance. You are nothing, dear friends, but a bag of chemical reactions. And why is it the chemical reactions in your body or the chemical reactions in the body of one that you care for and that you love are of more significance than that of a first grader doing his first science experiment where he makes a little volcano out of clay and dumps in the baking soda and dumps in the vinegar, and then there is the big gassy eruption that goes over, and maybe they even put a little dye in there so that it has a red color to it. And then when that science experiment is over, it's thrown in the trash. Nothing but a memory in the minds of those that participated in it. That's a science experiment that takes a while to create it, and it's done really, really quick. See, but even the person, even the so-called atheist that would make an argument that life comes from non-life, that nothing becomes something, it blows up and becomes everything, even such a person demonstrates that he knows that the body of his first grader that he is caring for, that he's looking after, that he's protecting, that he's providing for, the chemical reactions there within that person are different than that of this volcano that just went up and then went away and the carbon dioxide went into the air and that was it. But the problem is they have no basis for it. They've removed any basis for this, and it's incredible to see such a person that denies the existence of God, calls all religious people fools, calls them ignorant, calls them unscientific, though they have just participated in something that is incredibly philosophical and unscientific, but then go on to argue for all basis, you know, all reasons why there should be morality. They will argue against racism, but deny any basis for it, even though some of their views and their philosophies actually have their basis in racism, and furthermore even justify its reality because they don't recognize as men as being made in the image of God. No, it is clear, it is evident all around you, it is in the scriptures, and it is in the creation itself, it is in your mind, it is in your body. You are born with the ability to see this world and understand that it was brought into existence. You could merely look at a building. So many times I'll be standing downtown and someone will be explaining to me how there's no evidence for God. This person is breathing air. They just ate pizza. They're standing all around them on the one planet that anyone can find anywhere that can support life in the way in which this one can. Seems like the one place in the universe where you can find such a large amount of water. And that person will be standing there arguing, there's no evidence for the existence of God. I was like, is there evidence that someone brought that building into existence? Well, yes. Well, what evidence is there? Have you seen the blueprints? Have you met the man? Has he shook your hand? Have you had to see him? Oh, no, there's a building. So you just know there's a building here, and yet you are more complicated, dear friend, than that building. That building is brought up, it is raised, and it exists, but people are brought into existence, and they are self-sustaining. They grow, they mature, they reproduce. Way more complicated than the building. I would argue many of the cells in your body are of greater complexity than the car that you use to drive here today. This points to God. And God is the source of all life, and God is in need of nothing. God is blessing us by bringing us into existence. God is blessing us by giving us opportunity to serve him. God is blessing us by placing us in a world whereby we can see evidence of him. We can come into right relationship with him. We're not deserving of that. He owes that to no one. God is the source of all life. Job 22, beginning in verse 2, they ask this question: can a man be profitable to God? Surely he is wise, who is wise is profitable to himself. Is it any pleasure to the Almighty if you are right? Or is it gain to him if you make your ways blameless? How is it that you have changed God? No, God is complete in and of himself. Complete in and of himself. As it says in Psalm 148:13, because he is one who is worthy of our praise because of who we are. They say, let him praise the name of the Lord, for his name alone is exalted. His majesty is above earth and heaven. He is good in and of himself. As the writer of Psalm 119 says in verse 68, you are good and do good. Teach me your statutes. God is the source of life. God is the source of goodness. And we need to see our service to him as not adding anything to him, as not doing God a favor in some way. We are the ones that are blessed in this. He is sovereign over all people, and all people will give an account to him. As Paul says in Acts 17, beginning in verse 24, the Lord, or rather the God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of the heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives all mankind life and breath and everything. That's the reality. This is what Paul is saying to people that don't have a Bible. You know this to be true. You know God brought all things into existence. You know you have life from him. What do you think you're doing? Who do you think you are? Feeding God? Giving God food? This food that you sacrifice to these idols gets sold there in the market and you buy it later. Someone else is going to eat that. Your God's not eating that. God doesn't need your food. God has given you life. He has given you breath. And he is due your worship. Paul continues in verse 26. He says, and he made from man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. And even some of your poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. And of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. This is the reality. God has brought people into existence. He is sovereign over them, which is the next point that we're going to be walking into. And he is due our worship. We are ones who have been made in the image of God. How is it that we could go and take something that is even less than what we are? A stone, a piece of gold, some artwork. As great as any of that may be, it's less than the value of a human. And you're going to worship that which is of less significance than you and say that you're worshiping God. This idol that you had to make, this idol you had to bring into existence, you had to cut the tree down, you had to chop away on it, as Isaiah says. You got hungry partway through, grabbed some of it, cooked your food on it. You felt good after you ate your food, went back to work. You bow down and say, this is my God. You know, we can laugh at that. We're too sophisticated to worship God in that way. But we have our modern American ways of idolatry that we walk into. God is in need of nothing from us. We must remember that. We are the ones that are being blessed. That he has opened the door of opportunity for us to serve him. That he has opened your eyes that you can see who the Lord Jesus Christ is, that your relationship with him can be restored. and that it has been restored. And that must be the basis of your obedience to him. Not that you're growing him in some way. You're the one that's being blessed. You're the one that is not wasting your life, wasting your existence, going so far as even wasting your eternity. God has granted you that opportunity. That must guide our worship. Even when we gather on the Lord's Day, it is so easy to begin to walk into idolatry and to begin to make the worship of God all about the desires of men, the worldly desires of men. And such is not the worship of God. God is completely sovereign over his creation. That's what they emphasize in this next portion of the confession. They say, but only manifesting his glory in, by, unto, and upon them, he is the alone fountain of being, of whom, through whom, and to whom are all things, and he hath most sovereign dominion over all creatures to do by them, for them, and upon them whatsoever he pleases. These are difficult words for some people. Because we come from a culture where we like to talk about our rights and what we are deserving of. You don't want what you're deserving of, dear friends. There's a great book I read many years back, and it was about a woman that was a missionary in China, and it was called Have We No Rights? And she began to walk through the many comforts in life that she and many others had to lay down to minister to people in that particular culture at that time period. And argued that this was not a laying down of rights, but rather a laying down of her preferences, of her desires for the greater good of this people and for the glory of God. Romans 1, beginning in verse 34, Paul writes, for who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been his counselor, or who has given a gift to him that he might be repaid? God is sovereign. He's not needing our guidance. He's not needing our wisdom. He's completely sovereign. They're going to emphasize this a little more in the next portion of this confession, but the Lord is sovereign. He's not in need of us. He's not in need of our wisdom. One of the most incredible things I heard a Word of Faith preacher say once was that the Lord went to him and asked him his opinion. What kind of a God is that? One that needs to go to you to solve his problems? God that's just lonely and needs to have fellowship with you? Daniel 4 and verse 25 says this, that you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be among the beasts of the field. You shall be made to eat like grass, like an ox, and you shall be wet of the dew of heaven. 7 periods of time shall pass over you, till you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. And this is the Lord speaking to Nebuchadnezzar. And he's a man that was humbled. He was a man who was calling himself the Most High. And the Lord showed to him who is the Most High. That was a good thing. It is good to know that, to come to this recognition, to believe upon this side of glory, the side of death, the side of the grave. Do not go to the grave with a misunderstanding of who God is, the sovereignty of God, the goodness of God. And the Lord humbled this man, and we see his confession here in verse 34 of chapter 4 of Daniel. And it says, at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me. I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can say to his hand or say to him, what have you done? He came to this recognition. He thought of himself as being sovereign. He thought of himself as even being a God, one who should be worshiped. And the Lord humbled him. See this, when you don't see God right, it is one of the most dehumanizing things that you can do. You look at Romans chapter 1 and look at the behavior of those that deny who God is. They begin to worship and serve the creature rather than the creator. They begin to worship and serve that which is less than themselves. They begin to deny what they were given by God sexually and begin to chase after that which is contrary to reason and destructive to them as a people. Nebuchadnezzar came to this realization. The Lord humbled him. The Lord opened his eyes. I do wish that we had some more information here in Daniel as to what happened in the kingdom after this. That's just seems like I would have liked to have known. But it changes, and you have the next king that is there, and that's not really the point. The point is the sovereignty of God. This last portion of this part of the confession is, yes, God is really sovereign. He's really sovereign. They want to emphasize this. And it says this, in his sight, all things are open and manifest. His knowledge is infinite, infallible, and independent upon the creature, so as nothing is to him contingent or uncertain. The sovereignty of God is something that men have long felt that they need to apologize for. They felt that they need to qualify the sovereignty of God. So yeah, God's sovereign, but wait. And there are qualifications that the scriptures do give in this area, but they don't actually change God's sovereignty or his rule. That's why they word it in this way. And the two main reasons that men desire to qualify the sovereignty of God, it has to do with the existence of evil, and it has to do with men choosing that which is evil or choosing that which is good. And we're going to walk through a few ways that men have tried to deal with these things. The first is one called Pelagianism. And Pelagius is one who sought to qualify this. And what he did was he denied original sin. That's St. Augustine there on the right. St. Augustine, and that's Pelagius there on the left. And they had a debate because St. Augustine had given a prayer, and he prayed that the Lord would give them the ability to do what he commanded. And he was greatly offended by this. Pelagius said, how can you say that? How can you say that God would require something of us that he had to give us the ability to do? And he went so far as to deny original sin. He argued that you're basically born in a state that is similar to Adam and Eve. Now, mere reason contradicts this reality. He's obviously a man. He didn't have children of his own to make such an argument, and his statements directly contradict what Paul says. What Paul says there in Romans 3, none is righteous, no, not one. No one is good. No one seeks for God. Paul could not make those statements in Romans chapter 3 if what Pelagius says is true. This was deemed a heresy. Well, others saw other ways of dealing with it. A man named Jacob Arminius was concerned with the teachings of John Calvin. It's most especially the students of Jacob Arminius that had issues with the teachings of John Calvin, and of course in five particular areas. That's where we get the idea of tulip. John Calvin wasn't all into teaching these things only. If you look at the Institutes on the Christian Religion, he taught on a great many topics systematically, but these were the areas that the Arminian students had an issue with. And Arminius tried to deal with these things by saying that, okay, he didn't want to go so far as to agree with Pelagius, but he said, well, what the Lord does is he gives you a prevenient grace. You're born in a state of sin, but the Lord kind of opens your eyes, awakens you. Some will make this statement. They'll say, you know, you're dead, but he kind of brings you to life so that you're kind of on your sick bed now. And there's some medicine there, and you just need to take it. Another way this illustration is given is, well, you're drowning, and you're in the water, and Jesus is there, and he's throwing you a life preserver, and you've just got to grab it. If you'll just grab the life preserver, then you can be saved. Now, there's some problems with this, because the description that the Bible gives of us in our original state is dead. Paul says, no one is righteous, no, not one. No one seeks for God. He says, no one is good. So you're not doing righteous things. Turning to God is a righteous thing. But the Arminian argues there's this prevenient grace that kind of opens your eyes so you can make this choice. Well, that's a nice idea. Perhaps even you, in your experience, in your conversion, you kind of felt that way. That's kind of the way that people will feel sometimes, you know, in their conversion experience. There's a time where they're kind of wrestling with some things and you're coming to certain conclusions. And that may have been what happened to you, but you don't want to project that backwards onto, you know, your theology and soteriology and understanding how it is that people are saved. Because the idea of prevenient grace is not something that you're going to find in the Bible. It is a foreign idea. God has shown goodness to you. God has blessed you in ways that you're not deserving. There's many ways that the Lord has given you instruction prior to your conversion. And if you want to call that prevenient grace, okay. But there is no idea that the Lord kind of halfway wakes you up, just gives you enough life so that you can be awake enough and then just reach out and take that medicine. No, the Bible describes you as being dead or being alive. There's no middle state. You're dead in your trespasses and sins, or you're alive in Christ. You're a child of the devil, or you're a child of God. Only two states of existence that you can be in. So there's others that went so far as to say, well, you know, we need to do something about this. And they saw problems with Arminianism. And there's a man here, his name is Richard Rice. And we're getting to very modern times now. We're getting to some ideas that they began to look at, you know, things scripturally and really feel like, well, we need to apologize for who God is. And they began to think of this philosophically. And they began to say this, looking at even Arminianism. They said, now look, if you're an Arminian, you think that you can just choose on your own. You have an open choice. But the reality is God knows what you're going to choose. He knows what you're going to do. He knows what you're going to believe. And they would make this argument, well, if that is true, if God actually knows what it is that you're going to do, how is it that you can do that which he knows you're not going to do? So some of you science fiction people might be really thinking on this now, huh? This is maybe an episode of Doctor Who that maybe it's reminding you of one of those. Like, how is this supposed to, is this going to tear apart the fabric of time? Well, so they make this argument. This is a heretical book. Again, very recent, 80s. Richard Rice was pushing some of this stuff out. And they argue that if God knows what's going to happen, then you can't choose what he knows is not going to happen. Therefore, logically, they would argue, God does not know what you're going to choose. He has closed that off for himself. He has closed that section of his divinity off so that you can make your choice, and that what he knows that you're going to do can't be a factor in what it is that you're actually going to do. Well, there's so many ways that this contradicts the Bible. This contradicts the very doctrine of God. Now, we understand that Jesus in the flesh was not omnipresent. Okay, we understand that Jesus in the flesh was able to die. God can't die. Well, Jesus was human. That didn't happen to his divinity. In his divinity, he didn't cease to be omnipresent. In his divinity, he didn't die. God can't die. But this theology here is actually talking about the doctrine of God proper. It's talking about God in his, it's talking about the divinity of God. And you're saying that God can be God and not God at the same time, and that's not true. That's not true. In fact, there's numerous scriptures that make an argument for the opposite of what open theism says. Hebrews 4 and verse 13, and no creature is hidden from his sight, but all are naked and exposed to the eyes of him to whom we must give an account. Ezekiel 11 and verse 5, and the Spirit of the Lord fell upon me and said to me, say thus, thus says the Lord, so you think, O house of Israel, for I know the things that come into your mind. See, this is why the framers use the words that they do, that his knowledge is infinite, infallible, and independent upon the creatures. He's not in some way putting away parts of his attributes on our behalf. This is a terrible theology. Next I want to talk about is one called Molinism, and we're going to move through it quickly. This is a very complicated philosophy. It's one that does not have its basis in the scriptures, but there was a Jesuit priest, his name was Luis de Molina, and he created a theology known as Molinism. And he saw the teachings of the reformers, and he wanted to deal with it. He wanted to deal with the fact that God was sovereign, and yet there is evil in the world. Funny, that's one of the main charges that people will give against God. They will say, how can you say there's a God when there's so much evil in the world? Which is an interesting thing to say, because you're basically saying that God not existing would in some way give you a measurement whereby you could determine what is good and what is evil. If God doesn't exist, there is no good. There is no evil. It is whatever is in your mind is good to you. It's bad to you. What's in my mind is good to me. It's bad to me. If we don't agree at some point, might is going to make right, and we're going to work that out. But Molina was concerned that the Reformed doctrines impugn the character of God. And he would make this argument. He would say, and if God's sovereign over all things, and he's ordained all things to come to pass, then God is guilty for the sin that is in the world. So he sees a need to go and in some way, you know, take the stand for the Lord, to go and be a lawyer, an advocate for the Lord, and to argue for the Lord's righteousness and to separate him from the sin that is in the world. Now, I understand why people have concerns like this, because this is something that requires a little bit of higher order thought. It requires a little complexity to the thinking. But what we need to do is have this grounded in the scriptures. We need to not go and make up new ideas and new philosophies on a worldly basis to in some way justify God. God's not needing us to justify him. The Word of God says that God is sovereign. We don't need to begin by denying that. Molina begins by apologizing for that, begins by denying this. And so what he basically argues is that God brought into existence the greatest possible world that could come into existence. He looked through all the possible ways in which the world could have existed. He thought through what are the many facets, all the ways that you could have existed. I mean, just imagine it. Imagine yourself existing with perhaps different traits than you have, different talents that you have, different skills that you have. Perhaps you were born in another location. Paul talked about that. God's determined the times and places where we'll live. Perhaps he had put you somewhere else, and you would exist in that. And that would cause, you know, this butterfly effect of things to happen. And this would affect that, and then there'd be something over here. And the Lord thought through all of these different ways in which things could happen, all of these different contingencies. And the Lord, in his infinite wisdom, brought into existence the very best world that could exist. That's his theory. That's his philosophy. And so, when you see the evil in the world, you must understand, well, this is the best God could do with what he had when he was thinking through all of the different things that he could have brought into existence. This is the best one that he could have brought into existence. Well, there's a lot of problems with this philosophy. The first one, I would argue, is that God doesn't think. God's not pondering. Like, why do you think? You think because you are a finite being and you're taking in information. I have times where I need to process information. I just sit and think, and I have to do that because I have a small brain and I have to think through these things. God's not like that. He's never thought about anything. He's never pondered anything. It's compromising who God is. And the reality is, people that hold to this philosophy, there's a man named William Lane Craig that's the big proponent of this. He's out of Houston Baptist University right now. And he will compare God to a supercomputer. And you must understand that to call God something like a supercomputer, or to compare him to a supercomputer, is to be a great insult to the character of God. It is to slander God. If I called you a supercomputer, perhaps that might be a compliment. But that is not who God is. That is not what God is. God has not calculated all of the data that is there in existence. God just is. God just exists. And the reality is that the Lord is sovereign over all things, everywhere, at all times. And so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to end it at this point, and I'm going to begin with a biblical response to this. And I've gone over in my time, so I'm going to end it here. Let me close this in prayer, and we'll begin at this point next time when we walk through the confession. Let's go ahead and pray.